All right. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at the same number. Sandy Williams, it's Friday. That means Friday's with Sandy Williams. And Sandy, all is not lost. It looks like Joe Manchin is not going to be the kind of turncoat that everybody had made him out to be. The Republicans are saying he kind of stabbed them in the back and all those different things, Sandy. Democrats are celebrating. Was Joe Biden sly as a fox? I mean, Joe Manchin,
yeah,
sly as a fox doing all this time?
Well, it's sly as a fox in plain sight. back in the day they used to call what he was chasing pork. He was looking for benefits for West Virginia and for whoever it is that he was trying to pursue the interests for. Whether it be business interests or labor interests in West Virginia or personal interests. I mean, I don't know. But pork. And, you know, back in the day, LBJ was the master of distributing pork in order to get things passed, like the Civil Rights Acts and the things that he was famous for, because he was a famous wheeler and dealer. So I think probably Schumer just used his wheeling and dealing capacity as majority leader to accomplish the deal.
You know, Sandy, all of the, you know, $300 billion is going to go into green energy. We had the guy on yesterday who disputed things, but you said on Monday that this is not going away.
Green energy. Well, it's not going to go away because it's beginning to make
sense,
economic sense. And it's beginning to make financial sense to utilities to build the capitally intensive kinds of things like solar arrays and wind generation. So it's making financial sense. It's making economic sense. So it's going to happen. And then as time goes on and batteries and storage develop, it's going to make more and more sense, and it's going to happen faster and faster. So the thing that people don't recognize is when things change and things begin to make economic sense, they happen quite rapidly. Automobiles came on the scene. They came on the scene quickly. Trains, railroads came on the scene. They had a rapid impact. Computers, they were nothing until they were everywhere. And so, you know, it takes a little longer to build infrastructure, but look at how quickly we went from landlines to no landlines at all. You know,
Sandy, the out-of-pocket drug costs that people, whether they're Republican or Democrats, they bemoan the cost of prescription drugs and the fact that there's never been made any sense that Medicare should not be able to negotiate with the pharmaceutical company. I mean, that made no sense whatsoever, but it's been protected all of these years.
Well, the pharmaceuticals have this bogus argument that they need massive profits in order to do be inventive, and the technological innovation that the new medications they come up with are the result of the fact that they have so much extra money that they can expend on that kind of innovation. Well, we don't regulate that. We don't require that they do the innovation. They do the innovation that they want to because it has a higher return than potential return than sending the money back to their shareholders. They pay dividends, and when they get more profits, they pay bigger dividends. They also do innovation. And, you know, we just fell for it. The American political process fell for the argument, maybe because it was convenient, because pharmaceuticals were so actively involved in politics, meaning helping people get elected to office.
You know, I don't, for the life of me, I don't know how anybody who, the average American citizen or senior, who struggles with the cost of these medications and you know, this part of the aging process is that we're going to be on some meds, right?
And it's unbelievable how expensive some meds are. I mean, it's like ridiculously expensive. And the difference in expense between the generic drug and the non-generic drug can be astronomically different. And the capacity of the drug industry to charge whatever it is that the government is willing to reimburse them, and the main limit on that reimbursement after this no negotiation clause was inserted was how much could they charge before the news media put it before the public as to how much it was costing. Like, for instance, insulin. Insulin was a quiet problem until the news media began to generate the information showing how terribly expensive insulin had become, or forms of insulin had become, with this no negotiation clause.
You know, Sandy, here's, I had my thyroid removed, and so I take a thyroid medication, which I'll be taking for the remainder of my life. And so the thyroid medication was, they didn't have a generic brand of it until recently. And I think that based on some of the things I've been reading, there is a period of time in between the time that they develop a medication, then they can bring in a generic one.
Well, the generic has to do with the length of time for the patent and the applicability of the patent to the invented medicine that has derived a patent. And one of the problems is that, you know, patent policy is a matter of legislation. And we could decide that patents for medication require a different sort of protection and a different sort of regulation. And we could control the price, or we could at least control the amount of protection that a patent provided with respect to price. But, you know, patents create almost an unrestricted ceiling to what they can charge. When the patent expires, now it gets reduced to something closer to like the cost of production.
But Sandy, that those patent laws are created by the elected officials.
Absolutely.
And so my point is, we as citizens don't have to. I mean, we've got to find a way to bring the pressure necessary on those elected officials to do what's in the best interest of us. We can't seem to get that done right.
Right. So the patent restrictions are there supposedly to support innovation. There is a closer connection between the protection that is afforded patented drugs as compared to this no negotiation process that is talked about that has been established. But we need to wake up. We need to look at this. We need to look and see how other countries are dealing with it. And other countries clearly don't pay the same kind of prices for drugs. You know, you can buy drugs from Canada that are much, much cheaper. Same drugs.
I know. So the other part of this is, I remember reading where third world nations get the drugs cheaper than we do.
Sure.
And the pharmaceutical companies think that this is a great moral thing that they're doing, charging these lesser prices for the other nations, but it's at the expense of us.
Yeah.
And so, but I just don't think that the American people are aware enough, Sandy, of some things we should be able to change, there's some things that we shouldn't tolerate, and there's no way we should tolerate being gouged for the prescription drugs.
Long ago, we decided that the people who provided water to us in the pipelines under the street ought to be regulated because they shouldn't be able to charge anything at all for water, anything they wanted to, because water's a necessity. We'll die without it.
Right.
Some drugs are just exactly the same thing. People will die without them. They'll pay anything to get them, but should they be required to pay anything, or should they pay what is deemed to be a fair and regulated price? Same is true with electricity. Electricity comes from regulated utilities in most states, because otherwise they could charge us anything at all for it because it's a necessity. We don't allow that. We need to look at drugs more carefully and figure out how it is that we should both promote innovation, or at least allow innovation to exist, and make sure that we aren't gouged for pricing.
So here's one of the things that frustrated me, that my thyroid medication, when they finally came up with the generic brand, there was a push to raise the price of the generic brand in order to protect The original one.
Well, what does happen is that there's a brand name, okay, that's attached to the original one. And frequently, the drug manufacturer, when that patent expires, continues to make the drug under the trade name that was the patented version, and they also make a generic version of it so they can cover both sides of the street, right?
Yeah.
But they don't want to put a dent in the sale of that high priced, high markup trademark drug, so they jack up the price of the generic drug in order to make sure that not too many people jump from the trademark drug to the generic drug.
Well, Sandy, that's what do you call it? Dealing from both ends of the deck. Is that kind of what they're doing?
Yes.
You know, in all of these things, Sandy, in most instances, the American people are just not aware of those things. That information is not just out there. You've got to dig for that kind of information. You always talk about things being complex. That whole thing is complex. Because if you're thinking about, again, the people who developed that drug and they've got the original drug, they're not going to just all of a sudden go out of business because there's something generic coming down the pipe. And does it mean that the generic is as good as the original? I don't think it is.
The generics are identical.
Well, I know that's what they say.
No.
Are you serious?
I'm serious. I mean, to the extent that the FDA regulates adequately the efficacy of the production of these drugs, yeah, they're essentially identical.
The same
drugs.
Ingredients, everything.
Yeah. So that when you get a prescription from a doctor and he says you can take this and you can either buy this, the trade name drug, the trademark drug, or you can buy the generic drug, he, she is telling you that because they're identical.
Yeah, well, it's probably more than I can comprehend, because why would I buy the original if it's the same thing? And the generic is cheaper. What would be my incentive to buy the original?
Well, there's been some economic studies and surveys done about why trademarking makes a difference and why people follow brands and why people want to pay more for a branded product than an unbranded product. And it's psychological and it's subconscious, but yeah.
Sandy, we got to go to break. 844-967-2789. We'll be back. So... All right. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. It's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. You know, Sandy, man, that conversation that we're having off the air, we need to have on the air. Because I'm one of those people who, you know, man, if I want some vegetables, some frozen vegetables, I already know I'm going into the area where they've got Green Giant, right? And I'm like, that's a better vegetable. Mm-hmm. I know it's going to taste better. Why? Because Green Giant is on it. Well, now, I don't know that to be factual.
But you believe it's true because you think it does taste better.
Because I've seen the commercials nonstop.
Right. So branding is a complex thing, and I'm out of my area of true expertise, but I'll tell you what I do know about it. Branding involves some complicated thought processes. Number one, branding can tie actual value, can identify for you some actual values that are provided by the product that is branded as compared to other things. But branding is all about persuading the people who are understanding and learning about the brand that brand carries better value, and the price, the added price you're going to pay to get that brand is going to be, you're going to be rewarded for it by some better qualities associated with the product. And they persuade you of that. And you become persuaded of it, and you go out and you pay more to get that brand than you would something else. And once you've done that, you are extremely likely to think it is better, because there's another psychological process called cognitive dissonance, which lots of other parts of human behavior relate to, which is when you decide to do something that, for instance, costs you in some respect, like costs you more money, and you're doing it to chase some value, you either are going to decide that that value is there, or you have to decide that you're a fool. And people don't like deciding that they're fools. They like being, and so they get married to brands because they've paid more for it over time. They've always thought that it tasted better, and either it tastes better or they're acting foolishly. And so they stay married to the brand. That's a big part of getting tied to brands.
Well, but we
so you're not exactly a fool, because maybe Green Giant tastes better, but
maybe
it doesn't.
Well, you know, Sandy, it kind of does, right?
Okay.
I mean,
well, except you haven't tasted many other brands for quite a while because you're so married to Green Giant, right?
Yeah, you know, Sandy, I was watching one of the news stations, and they were trying to get people to save money, and they were saying, okay, we've got one of our people is going to go in and they're going to buy the same food, but one with brand name, one without brand name.
Mm-hmm.
And it was almost 50% savings. They bought the same things, you know, brand name and others. And I think the brand name was about $400 and some odd. The other one was $190. That's a major difference. But I would venture to say, since I'm the brand guy, I mean, I've always...
Well, here's another thing, that the economists and psychologists have done the same survey, and it works every time. And that is, you can take a product, certain kinds of products, and you can have them, and you can survey people, and you can say, this product costs this much, will you buy it? And then they reduce the price, and now it costs this much, will you buy it? And when they reduce the price low enough, people will stop buying it because they don't believe that it could still be good and be that cheap. And similarly, there are brands that rely upon being expensive to be acquired. You know, if you Rolex watches are only attractive if they're expensive. If you can buy that watch for $150, you're not going to buy it.
You know, Sandy, and after it's all said and done, they kind of do the exact same thing, right? Only that Rolex is a major investment that's going to hold its value.
Yeah.
The other watches...
Well, it's going to hold its value because there are other fools lining up later on. I mean, I own one. But, you know, the fact is that luxury goods and luxury brands rely on the branding of it to be important to create value in the person's mind. But this same kind of brand complex works up and down the line with all kinds of products.
You know, Sandy, the amazing, is this all human nature? Or is this that people clearly marketing is a lot more involved in marketing than any of us can ever imagine?
Well, maybe the fact is that human nature is a lot more complicated than we can imagine, and marketing is just developed a science of understanding human nature so that it can understand how to wheedle us into doing things that we might otherwise not do.
Well, you know, sometimes we know better, right? And I'm looking at, even in my own life, even the clothing that you buy and wear, right? If you go into a place, it doesn't even necessarily have to be a high end store, but you know, if what's the name of this? I was just thinking about the one of these clothing stores.
Well, you know, here there's a different. You can take Brooks Brothers men's store that has expensive men's clothing, and you can compare it to a low cost men's clothing store, and you can find remarkably comparable clothing in each place.
Sandy, the Brooks Brothers suit is not going to have the
Well, no, you're talking about style. I'm just talking.
No, I'm not talking about style. I'm talking about the quality of the thread. And
there you go.
And oh, that's, they've got me then, is what you're telling me.
I think they got you.
Well, but the thread is not going to be hanging off my new suit if I bought it at Brooks Brothers. They're going to make sure that all of that stuff is just right.
A lot of this all changed when, because you find out that the Brooks Brothers suit is made in the same factory in Vietnam as the suit from Men's Warehouse.
Yeah.
So.
You know, that's kind of an amazing thing, but true, right?
Could be. I don't know. Yeah. I'm making this stuff up a little bit.
Oh, but I'll tell you something. It's the quality of, it's just like they talk about sheets, right?
Yeah.
600 or 1,000
count.
And you somehow think that there's this major difference in the sheet.
Well, there.
It's real.
It's real because they're telling you something that needs to be true. It's got 1,000 threads per unit.
So that needs to be
600.
That needs to be true because somebody is monitoring that.
It's a, yeah, that kind of stuff needs to be true. Otherwise it would be a fraudulent advertising.
All right, gotta go to a break. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back. So term commodities thrown around and
first of all, the commodity, what a commodity is it's something that is a product where each one of them is more or less interchangeable, right? So you go into someplace, you want 12 apples. Now you might decide that you want to really pick and choose between the apples, but apples are apples and oranges are oranges. Eggs are eggs. You get 12 eggs, you get them in a carton.
Right.
They're all pretty much interchangeable. Those are commodities, products that are pretty much interchangeable with one another. One egg is like another egg.
Yeah, but the quality of them are...
So commodities might have differential qualities. So there's grade A eggs, there's grade A large eggs. They break eggs down into different commodities that are the grades of eggs. Grade A, grade double A, brown, large, brown, small. I mean, we're really into eggs here. But... Yeah, so you can see that eggs are a commodity, but there are different grades of that commodity, each one of which has been established so that everything within that grade of that commodity can be dealt with interchangeably. One grade A brown egg is the same as another grade A brown egg, essentially.
Yeah, so
same is true with coal, same is true with all kinds of oranges. You know, there might be grades that you'll buy, but everything within a grade is a commodity.
So in the commodity, speculation plays a big role. Is that how that's done?
Well, commodities are things that get produced, right? And they get produced over time. So that some commodities come pretty much right away, like coal. You take it out of the ground, but you build piles for it. But you don't use all the coal in one day, and you need to have, if you have a factory or if you have a power plant, you need to buy coal for out into the future, and you don't want to know what your coal is going to cost next year and the year after. You don't want to be surprised by that. So people will tend to buy coal a year out and 2 years out. They're speculating when they buy it at a price in the future, and the person who's selling it to them is speculating when they decide to sell it to them at a price in the future, because in that future time, the so-called spot market, the price that's being paid that day for coal purchased that day and used that day might be higher or lower than what you've decided to pay for it out in the future.
So if you bought, oil is a prime example.
Yeah.
So the gas prices were over $5. Yeah. Couple months ago.
Well, if you had a 1,000-gallon tank in your yard and you could fill it with gasoline, you might speculate, because when the price got down to $2.99 a gallon, you might say, you know what? I think this is about as cheap as gas is going to get. You call up the gasoline supply guy and you say, come fill up my 1,000-gallon tank. And you just bought 1,000 gallons of gasoline for $3,000. $3 a barrel,
right?
Or $3 a gallon. Now, if the price of gasoline goes up, Now you were smart. If the price goes down from $299, you weren't so smart, but you speculated by deciding to lock in the price at $299. If you don't use any gasoline out of that tank, you're going to buy it from what's called the spot market. You're going to go out and buy it from the gas station down the road, and you'll pay whatever the day's price for gasoline is. And the day's price might be $4.99 a gallon like it is today, or it could 4 months from now be $2.95 a gallon.
So the reason why I guess that's so important, we're watching right now, as you predicted, these oil prices are starting to come down. And, you know, a month or so ago, it was $5.
Right.
And now it's...
It was 5.50, 5.40
somewhere.
Yeah. I mean, it was up and it's going down. It goes down a little slower than it goes up. Some of that has to do with the fact that people fill up their tanks. Like the gas station fills up its big tank and
right.
around, and they've got a price that they paid for that gas, and so they want to recover that price from it before they drop the price below. They don't want to lose money for each gallon they sell, so that's going to form a floor for how rapidly they'll drop the price.
So that's why some of the service stations, you can see that their gas price is still higher than what you see other places. They're selling what they still have in the ground.
Well, they're doing that. They're also judging their market. They might have a local neighborhood market that comes to them because they're convenient, and a station that has convenience sales is less likely to be strictly competitive on price. They're gonna charge something for their convenience. If you get close to a freeway, if you're at a truck stop, that's pretty competitive there. They're going to charge whatever the lowest price is being charged for gas so that they can sell the gas they've got. And that price of gas is a commodity, and it relates to the future price that was paid for the gas out there to the oil to convert to gas. But commodities are very volatile, and they're volatile because it's a question of supply and demand day by day. The day-by-day supply and demand for a product, for a commodity, sets the price of the commodity in the very short term. And then people set the price by future contracting for what they're going to pay for it out into the future. And you're speculating no matter what you do. You're speculating by buying it at today's so-called spot price, that day-to-day price, because you're thinking that it's not worth it to jump into the long-term market, or you don't have the ability to jump into the long-term market, but you're deciding that based on your circumstances.
So there is no crystal ball. All you can do is, you know, like you just stated, but so does it make sense for the American people to know those things? Does it help for the American people to know this is what the ins and outs of the economy and all those things?
Well, it definitely helps if you are a buyer of lots of stuff, or if you're a producer. I can guarantee you farmers know all about this because they're in that business.
Right.
Oil stations know all about this because they're in this business, and they sort of understand it. The public, we aren't in a position to really so-called hedge. Hedging means to do something that can protect you from these changes. If you're in the American public and you simply buy groceries, you're going to go to you can only pay the day's price. If you're in the American public and you drive a gasoline-fired car, you can only pay this local day's price. So it doesn't help us to know a lot about it because there's nothing much we can do about it.
You know, Sandy, I think the more... And I think probably I'm concerned more so than I should be about the impending recession because having, you know, lived through some and knowing this is coming and just the price of things and just holding off on things, right?
Well, it definitely can be used, the knowledge about, and white durable goods are not necessarily a commodity, but durable goods aren't as variable in price, but automobiles have obviously shown volatility. But Certainly durable goods, cars, washing machines, dryers, things that you buy that will last for years and which you can sort of decide when you're going to buy. You know, you can have a car and you can continue to fix it, or you can buy a new one. And buying the new one is a big lump payment. Fixing it is smaller payments. So you can decide about that. Same with a washing machine, a dryer, a freezer, a refrigerator. So all of those things have a timing aspect to it, and you can decide more or less when to buy it. Your wife can push you into buying a new car when it isn't necessarily smart to buy a new car.
Right.
Earl.
Come on, man.
Or you can wait, and that waiting would depend on your knowledge about the market and what's likely to happen to it.
Yeah, well, Sandy. Anyway,
yeah.
I'm gonna take a deep exhale with that one. But you know, Sandy, I I do know, man, just the value of the things that you bring to the table when we're talking about the things that the everyday citizen has to deal with and is looking at, because you've kind of been on the money with almost all these things. And I like to bring that kind of information to the listening audience, because we almost act like we're sheep and there's nothing we can do about these things. In many instances, there aren't, but you certainly should know that they're coming.
Yeah, I mean, currently, certainly people who are looking at durable goods should be interested in inflation and what inflation is today and what it's likely to be in the future. The problem is there's no crystal ball here. So in the 70s, people who were looking at trying to have a crystal ball were probably wrong, because they thought inflation would slow down. It took a long time for it to slow down. But, you know, if I were in the market for a durable good now, I'd probably wait, because
right.
This is a period of shortage. And the prices being bid for everything like that is probably at the highest point it's going
to
be.
All right, got to go to break. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back.
We're living proof and all's alert that we're two from the complexion. And we're a winner. And everybody knows it too. We just keep on pushing. Like your leaders tell you to. At last that blessed day has come. And I don't care where you come from. We're all moving on up. Moving on up. Lord have mercy, we're moving on up. Moving on up. There'll be no more.
All right. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us that same number. It's Friday. That means Fridays with Sandy Williams. You know, Sandy, the global economy. And I remember, this is probably 30 years ago, the pound was one of the strongest measures.
50 years ago.
How many?
50.
Was it that long ago?
Oh, yeah.
What happened to the pound?
Well, I mean, the pound, there was a time before World War II when English commerce, the financial center of the world was London, and commerce was being conducted in the pound, so that if you were buying, rugs in Persia, you bought them in pounds because you didn't want to convert your stuff, your money to the Persian currency, and the Persians wanted to receive a currency they trusted, so everyone trusted the pound. That got replaced by the dollar during the 50s, and by the 60s, the dollar had replaced the pound as the world currency because of the trust generally in the currency, and the extent to which the currency was involved in world commerce. The United States was the biggest exporter in the world. We were a big importer. We were the biggest player on the world stage after World War II, so it was pretty easy for the dollar to become that currency. And it did. So the pound went into the shadows in that respect. It's still a trusted currency. It's just not the world currency.
But the euro, and I remember...
Well, Well, the euro has been trusted because it reflects such a big economy, and it, you know, it was launched in the 90s, but almost immediately became a trusted currency because of the nature of what was behind it, which was this economy almost as big as the United States economy, which was the European economy. And what's interesting, though, is currency. So we talk about a strong dollar. And until I sort of learned more about it, it seemed like saying that the dollar got stronger was a good thing, right? Oh, my gosh, the dollar's stronger. Now we can beat our breast. We've got a powerful dollar. Well, the dollar is almost as strong as it has ever been compared to other currencies. And having a strong dollar, it turns out, it's not such a good thing if you're trying to export products to the rest of the world, because your exported products are more expensive in that foreign currency when they convert from one to another, right? So if it takes more euros to buy a dollar today than it did a year ago, then every American product is more expensive in Europe today than it was, and that's the case. The euro is below or at parity with the dollar now. It was common that a euro cost $1.35 in the past. So it's gone down, 35% or some such number. And the same is true with respect to the dollar against all these currencies. And the fact that the dollar is the world currency has also created conversion problems as it's gotten so very strong for all the people in those transactions. So there actually are Bloomberg and the Wall Street Journal and others in the last day or two have been writing about how their belief is that this terribly strong dollar is pushing the global economy closer to a serious problem. And the problem is the strength of the dollar.
Sandy. So.
And incidentally, it is a problem for exporters in the United States. The stronger the dollar, the worse our balance of payments will be, because the stronger the dollar, the cheaper everything is that we import. So that strong dollar is to some extent helping us deal with inflation, because everything we're importing is cheaper.
So all these other countries certainly want to get as many dollars as they can get their hands on, right? I mean, No,
not when it's so strong, because it's expensive to get. But many countries have a lot of dollars because of all the transactions they've had and the balance of payments. For instance, China has a lot of dollars.
And so they hold on to the dollars until they become weaker, and that's when they would transfer the dollars to other currencies?
Well,
you would think that they'd hold on to them while they're strong.
Well, they hold on to them while they're strong. They invest them in financial instruments that are also denominated in dollars, i.e. American financial instruments. So the strong dollar, in terms of its impact on the U.S. situation, is problematical, because it's going to cause our balance of payments to suffer. Other countries will hold those dollars, but I'm not sure whether that's good or bad for the U.S. economy. And the strengthening of that dollar creates problems in transactions, to the point that I suppose theoretically there's a chance that a dollar that is always getting stronger could lose its status as the world currency because of that very problem.
So, let me ask you, small business in this country that has just been recovering from the COVID times, and you see them springing up and basically coming back to life, not anywhere near where they were, but you have seen some changes. These small companies are gonna, with what's coming down the pipe, we're gonna lose a lot of them.
Well, one of the problems with dealing with expansion and inflation is that they put the brakes on the ability to buy things, and in fact, Powell was talking about the need to have something like a shrinkage in the economy as a solution to shortage. All of that stuff that takes money out of the pockets of Tom, Dick, and Mary can hurt small business, can hurt restaurants, can hurt a variety of small businesses that basically rely upon expenditures and discretionary expenditures by Tom, Dick, and Mary.
So
discretionary expenditures And people who rely on discretionary expenditures get damaged in times of recession.
So because they're not going to be able to, let's go to the phone lines quickly. CJ, quickly, what do you say?
Well, thank you for taking my call, Sandy and Earl. Yes, this inflation hurts people on the lower end of the spectrum, and redefining recession and worrying about that, they're running out of words to redefine. The Inflation Reduction Act does nothing for Tom, Dick, and Harry. And the renaming of Build Back Broke doesn't do anything for Tom, Dick, and Harry. The sad thing is that we're actually hurting people more now, because now we're begging Iran and Venezuela and other countries, communist countries, to produce oil when we could be doing that to reduce our inflation. So thank you, Sandy, for touching on that, because this economy is going to get nothing but worse by the influx of trying to save it. We're actually hurting it.
So well, let me say, CJ, that this Science and Chips Act that's been bipartisan support is something that could it's the nature of the kind of thing that government can do to help Tom, Dick, and Mary, because one of the ways to solve shortage is to or to solve inflation is to solve the shortage side of it, which is to improve production and to put people to work more efficiently into that production process. And one of the big problems with this inflation, and almost all economists agree, is that it's driven by supply side fractures and friction in the economy that's causing shortages. So solving for that friction is something that actually does help Tom, Dick, and Mary, and there is this recent legislation that's aimed at doing some of that. So, you know, getting more oil production is only a little bit of the problem, and actually the oil companies, there's nothing impeding their production right now. There's something that's standing in the way of some of their exploration, but not current production. And refining capacity is what's short, CJ, and I don't think anyone's blaming the current administration for the shortage of refining capacity.
Well, on day one, they attacked energy production, Sandy, so the mere fact...
Well, I'm talking... I'm just CJ, just to, well, I just to get through that little bit of laughter, what I was talking about is refining capacity, not well production, and refining capacity...
Why would oil companies invest, Sandy, when this president is promising to kill their industry? Why would they invest in it?
Well, because investments are made.
You call it a giggle.
No, well, investments are made with much more than a four-year window, CJ. And so I think what's happening is that the financial community and the oil investors are worried about the long run for the oil industry, and they are therefore worried about making massive investments that require the long run to earn their return.
Well, this president made 4 years worthless for those oil companies.
Hey, CJ, thank you very much for the call. I really appreciate
it.
All right, Sandy, thanks as always. What you got lined up for the weekend?
Usually I get the agendas provided to me. I'm not sure.
All right, you got to go. Thank everybody who made the weekend. Oh, made the week go. Thank you, Connor. Got to go to a break. Oh, we're done. See you guys later. Bye.
We just keep on pushing, like Martin Luther told you to. And I don't mind leaving here to show the world we have no fear, because we're moving on up, moving on up. Lord have mercy, we're moving on up, we're moving on up.